This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We're sending medicines to Port Sudan, and it is very important that the medicines don't get stuck in Port Sudan, that they actually make it to the clinics and hospitals that need it the most, because those doctors and nurses and health workers that are there, they need those medicines.
That was Project Hope President and CEO Rabi Torbay saying Sudanese health workers are near the breaking point as the conflict there enters its third month. Details coming up. Also, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir plans to run for re-election. And a new report has detailed the destruction and looting of museums and cultural sites during Sudan's civil war. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has vowed to hold elections at the end of the country's transitional period as scheduled. Kiir said he will work with parties to implement the peace agreement to pave the way for voting to achieve permanent stability in the country. William Sunday Mabor reports for VOA from WOW.
Thousands of SPLM-IG supporters at the stadium in Western Barlagazal State, capital WOW, chanted slogan Tuesday, praising President Salva Kiir during a rally to endorse President Salva Kiir as the party's presidential candidate in the next year elections. Addressing thousands of party supporters, President Kiir says there will be no more extension of the transitional periods beyond 2024. Kiir welcomed his endorsement as his party's presidential candidate for the next year's elections.
I am deeply touched by your endorsement to be the SPLM flag bearer in 2024. Your continued support for our historic party gives me confidence that we will stand together as we go towards elections next year. It is also on this basis that I wholeheartedly accept your endorsement. This is your endorsement, and I have accepted it. For those who still doubt the SPLM unity, today Barlagazal has spoken.
President Kiir says the country's governance system will change after the general elections. He says the current mandate of the transitional government of national unity ends in 2024, as stipulated in the country's roadmap.
As the party, let us work on the basis that there will be no extension of this transitional period. When it ends in 2024, let us not think of further extension. It will not be extended. We have to go for election so that people know themselves. We will work closely with the party to the agreement to put them in place and pave the way for election. That will put our country to the path of permanent stability.
President Salva Kiir said his conflict with the armed opposition drains the national resources for developing the country. He says he put an end to fighting across the country to give room for development in South Sudan.
War takes away resources from service delivery. These were interrupted by the senseless war which we fought from 2013 to 2018. Its intensity stops implementation of government plans, and it is for these reasons that I signed the Revitalized Peace Agreement in 2008. I did not want it to continue, not because we were being defeated. I thought it was better to stop it from going ahead.
The president says his government will use the available resources to improve the living conditions of the South Sudanese.
We have initiated national projects. We have road construction going on in different parts of the country, including a highway
that is coming here to Barlagazal. It has already come to Tarakeka and it will come all the way to one here. We will work step by step to improve our living conditions. Whatever resources that are available now will be invested in our community.
He appealed the signatories of the 2018 peace agreement to put aside the conflict-related plans and focus on the service delivery to South Sudanese. First Vice President Riek Machar did not attend the event for endorsing President Salva Kiir as the flag bearer of the Sudan People's Liberation Party in 2024 scheduled elections. For VOA News, I am William Sande Mabur in Wau.
In Sudan, as the conflict between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces enters its third month after another failed ceasefire, healthcare workers find themselves near the breaking point as the health system is on the verge of collapse. That's according to the group Project Hope, which is sending nearly 5,000 pounds of critical medicines and medical supplies to Port Sudan. Project Hope President and CEO Rabi Torbay tells VOA's Carol Van Dam nearly two-thirds of hospitals and medical facilities in the capital Khartoum and Darfur have been destroyed or severely damaged.
We have health workers that are doing their best with no access to medicine or equipment, and in a very insecure environment. So their mental health, as well as their well-being, and their inability to help patients is really impacted them severely.
What has Project Hope, despite all those difficulties, what has Project Hope been able to do in Sudan?
We've been providing support to a local organization called NEDA. They've been providing mental health and psychosocial services, as well as counseling for victims of gender-based violence. But also, in addition to that, we're sending medicines to Port Sudan. And it is very important that the medicines don't get stuck in Port Sudan, that they actually make it to the clinics and hospitals that need it the most, because those doctors and nurses and health workers that are there, they need those medicines. There's nothing more difficult for a doctor or nurse to see a patient that's sick that they could actually treat if they had the medicine and the equipment and the supplies, but their hands are tied and they see actually patients dying because of that.
Is delivering aid to Khartoum and Darfur still as dangerous as it was a few weeks ago?
It still is, especially with the violence, you know, erupting again. Access is very difficult. Obviously, we need a ceasefire. We need peace. The people of Sudan need peace. But in the absence of that, we need some, humanitarian corridors so we can access those populations in Khartoum, in Darfur, and other affected areas to make sure that they get the humanitarian aid that they need.
We've had a number of ceasefires announced before. Has there been a break in violence that was, measurable? And were you able to get those corridors started?
I mean, those corridors have gone on and off depending on the ceasefires. For example, we were hoping for a ceasefire during Eid al-Adha, but that ceasefire didn't hold. And violence erupted again in Khartoum. And access becomes really difficult, especially to hospitals and clinics that are in those combat-affected areas. But throughout the country as well, I mean, there's insecurity throughout the country. If you want to try to get anything into Darfur as well, even without fighting logistically, it's, historically it's difficult. You can imagine now with the fighting, trying to access Niala or Al-Janina in West Darfur and trying to get medicines and medical supplies there is very difficult.
Yeah. What is the situation inside those hospitals in El Janina, in Darfur, in Khartoum?
The reports we've been getting is that the situation is dire. There's a serious lack of medicines and medical supplies. And we're seeing influx of, displacement internally within Sudan. I believe the latest number was about 2.2 million people displaced inside Sudan. And over 650,000 people have fled Sudan into neighboring countries.
That's Ralf Torbay, President and CEO of Project Hope. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Only Maryland. Mm-hmm. Libya's House of Representatives and its Consultative State Council intend to issue a new roadmap next week that will allow for the formation of a new government and the drafting of electoral laws. The aim is to hold long-delayed parliamentary and presidential elections. Some analysts and political observers see the move as a challenge to the head of the Government of National Unity, Abdulhamid Dabiba, who has refused to hand over power. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
The HOR, the House of Representatives, and the HCS, the High Council of State, are two unelected rump parliaments left over from 2014 and 2012 elections that were given this role by the 2015 Libyan political agreement and decisions by the 2021 UN-sponsored Libya Political Dialogue Forum. The role of these two rump parliaments is just to organize elections. It's not to tell the executive branch what to do. Now, the roadmap that's proposed is the result of what's called the 6+6 negotiations. So six representing the East and six representing the West that were happening in late May, early June, and broke down on June 6th when they failed to solve the thorniest electoral issues. The biggest issue was who can run for president. And the main reason that was an issue is that when the elections that were supposed to happen in 2021 broke down, the main reason was that Haftar, the general of the East, who's considered a war criminal by the international community, and Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, the son of the former leader, were approved to run for president. And that was a problem. Now, their supporters are trying to block the current president, Dabiba, from the West from running based on promises in 2020 not to run before this issue of anti-democratic candidacies came up. Now, it's clear Dabiba won't step down until there's free and fair elections. And now this roadmap's been rolled out, which we don't know yet if it's going to be a step forward, because there's no indication that the big disagreements over the elections have been solved. It may just be that they're announcing a roadmap with the date they said March 2024 without an actual solution to the bigger problems. Now, the Eastern government, they're threatening an oil blockade of 70% of Libya's oil if they don't get their way. So it's unclear whether this roadmap that's going to be announced is real or it's just a ruse because the East is threatening to blockade the oil again, which would devastate the economy and devastate European oil and gas supplies in the context of the Ukraine war.
HOR Speaker Aqila Saleh emphasized the need for a unified government on the entire Libyan soil with specific tasks to organize the elections, and the State Council head Khaled al-Mishri said if Dabiba refuses to hand over power to the new government, other measures will be taken. Who would be able to take such measures?
Saleh can say whatever he wants, but he only represents a third of the population in the East, and he doesn't have the power to do that. So the East has been trying to tear apart the Western government almost since it was formed in 2021 after the failure to take Tripoli by force in 2019 failed. And then they tried to install an Eastern prime minister on two occasions with armed conflicts, you may remember, in 2021, 2022, and that failed. And now they're trying to bring down the Western government by this new method. So this caretaker government idea, it seems to be a bad idea because it's just trying to replace the Western government without necessarily a government that the West wants, which is supposed to come out of elections. Now, the big question behind that is why is Mishri agreeing? It seems to be that because certain militias in the West involved in arms trafficking and drug smuggling and human trafficking to Europe were bombed by Turkish drones in three locations in May and June. And these militias were very angry and have some influence on Mishri, which is why there isn't Mishri's sort of trying to put this pressure on Dabiba to step down for this caretaker government, but Dabiba was not going to step down. In the meantime, the United Nations and the U.S. has sort of picked up this talking point that a caretaker government, if the Libyans want it, you know, might be good to have in place to help organize elections. But what they're not explaining well is that there's absolutely no way that Dabiba, who runs the Western government, is going to step down without elections. And he said this on multiple occasions. So Mishri can say that we want this caretaker government, but he doesn't have the power to force Dabiba out of power. And one other point to make is that elections have been happening in Libya since 2011, in the West, right up till the present. In the East, there have been no elections since Haftar, the general, took over in 2014. And what they're trying to do is use either the pre-election negotiation or the elections themselves to force a candidate in that the East and that Egypt supports, what some people are referring to as a selection and not an election, because they haven't really proven their democratic bona fides. So that's the issue right now.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Several climate scientists say the world recorded the hottest day on record yesterday. North Africa has recently seen temperatures near 50 degrees Celsius. Paolo Seppi, a climate scientist and lecturer at the Grantham Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the Imperial College of London, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam yesterday's sweltering heat underscores how some areas will be more affected by climate change than others, especially Africa, because of different exposure to risk.
What happens is you have a certain change in the climate, but how that's experienced by people depends on how well a particular country or community is prepared to face with the impacts. And to give you one example, one of the great impacts of climate change is sea level rise. So the sea levels are rising globally. We've already had 20 centimeters of global mean sea level rise since the beginning of the 20th century. And that's set to continue. We expect at least another 30 centimeters or so by the end of this century. And that is a lot, actually, for coastal communities, and particularly in countries that are less able to equip themselves with the infrastructure to protect their coasts against rising seas and storm surges and so on. Maybe another one I can mention is, changes in the patterns of rainfall. So some regions are going to get drier, some are going to get wetter. And so you have risks associated with flooding on the one hand, but also droughts on the other hand. And that requires a solid water supply infrastructure. So you need to have the infrastructure in place to bring the water where it's needed. And again, countries are quite unequal in that respect.
Let's talk about just yesterday in North Africa. It was said that the temperature was recorded at 50 degrees Celsius. Oh, my gosh. I mean, how are people surviving in that kind of heat?
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, that points to the health impacts of climate change and particularly the hot spells that are becoming both more frequent and more intense. Just to give some context, scientists have calculated, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change specifically in their last assessment report, they calculated that for 1 degree of global warming, and we're already at beyond that, 1 degree Celsius of global warming, we're at 1.2 degrees currently, we expect a fivefold increase in the likelihood of an extreme heat wave that would have occurred only once in 50 years. So that's happening five times as often now. And at the same time, it's also more intense. So there are studies showing that some regions on the globe are likely to become, at least at certain times, inhabitable. In a sense, you know, just being there will be a health hazard unless you have air conditioning and are in an air conditioned room.
It sounds to me that you're saying whole communities are going to have to move that don't have air conditioning. They're not like America. They don't have air conditioning where they can just, you know, if they don't have it in their own home, they can go to a shopping mall or something. They have no escape. So are these communities going to have to up and leave?
Well, unfortunately, I'm sure that one of the impacts of climate change, one of the more indirect impacts, will be mass migration. Or I think a lot of these impacts will be subtle in the sense that it's not always the case that the linkages are so clear. But you can expect, for example, that if in one region you're experiencing water stress and crop failures, that will add to the maybe existing political instability that's already ongoing. And so that will be an extra ingredient to the explosive mix that's already in place and might trigger civil wars or mass migration because of poverty and so on. So all of this is speculative, but I think it's not far-fetched to envisage that more migrations will happen as a result of climate change.
That's Paolo Seppi, a climate scientist at the Imperial College of London. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam. Founded by a former refugee, Epimonia, a company based on the U.S. state of Minnesota, turns material from life jackets worn by refugees into fashion accessories and other items of clothing. VOA's Kali Abdu has the story.
These are not ordinary life jackets. They were worn by refugees from different parts of the world who risked their lives crossing the Mediterranean Sea to reach Europe. Now they've been turned into a fashion collection created by Epimonia, a Minnesota-based company launched in 2018. The parents of Epimonia's founder, Mohamed Malin, fled Somalia during the conflict in the 1990s. Malin was born in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp complex before resettling in the U.S.
We take those life jackets and turn it into a fashion piece. You know, the purpose behind that is, you know, to create awareness of the refugee crisis globally and to support refugees, you know, through sustainable fashion.
Malin's fashion collection and some of the life jackets and boats used by the refugees were part of a live exhibit on June 17 at a gallery in Washington. The event featured installations and poetry that humanized stories of the refugee crisis in the Mediterranean Sea.
This exhibit basically it's a moment where, you know, we respect and we honor the refugees, you know, fleeing. We tell the stories of the refugees that flee from the home country.
The UN's International Organization for Migration, or IOM, says the Mediterranean Sea is one of the world's most dangerous maritime crossings. The route has so far claimed more than 20,000 lives since 2014, according to IOM's director.
The boat starts to slow down. The captain turns around with a loaded gun and says it's getting heavy.
For this exhibit, Malin collaborated with Somali-American poet and author Elias Yabaro, who goes by his stage name Alaku. Yabaro says the goal of the event is to bring people closer to personal stories.
The new story of this type of journey is always just numbers. You know, it's 9 people off the coast of this and 12 people off the coast of that. And you don't really understand who these people are or why they're driven to leave a country they call home. And so we really wanted to just, you know, make this very tangible.
Malim says he wants his fashion pieces to tell the story about the journey of the refugee who wore it.
3 people have to go now. Mohammed and Fatima.
Kali Abdu for VOA News, Washington.
While they were holding hands, Samira was 6 months pregnant, but still required to meet those demands.
Outrage has erupted in South Africa over a video of the president's security officers stomping on a man on a freeway over the weekend. The clip shows a group of armed plainclothes officers assigned to protect Deputy President Paul Masatali dragging the man out of a car and then stomping on his head until he lies motionless. At least 3 of the 7 officers involved are also seen kicking another man who holds his hands over his head to protect himself. Masatali's office said in a statement that he abhors any unnecessary use of force, particularly against unarmed civilians. The Independent Police Investigative Directorate, which handles cases of misconduct by police, said it has opened an investigation into the alleged assault by police officers. The Police Protectorate unit is known in South Africa as the Blue Light Brigade and has a reputation for using excessive force. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.